From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Yante Wong is my guest this week. His new book is Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. It's a fascinating examination of the character Charlie Chan, as well as the real-life man who inspired the fictional detective. It's also part memoir. It's about the Chinese-American experience. It's a history of the Hawaiian Islands and a lot more. Yante Wong, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary.
You know, it seems like years after it was acceptable for white performers to appear in blackface, actors regularly impersonated Asians. Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, or Buddy Hackett's comedy routine, you know, one from column A and one from column B. Have you ever heard that one? Why do you think that was so?
Well, I mean, of course, we have to talk about, you know, racial casting in Hollywood. Although, on the other hand, you know, there's also another factor, which is so-called, called a star system in Hollywood. It's really about who is the best actor. So there, you know, it's a mixture of the two. On the one hand, it's the race, you know, racism. On the other hand, it's also about talent. But it doesn't mean that, you know, there were no, you know, talented Asian actors to do the job. I don't mean to say that at all, but it's just the whole environment, the racist environment, you know, with the production code and everything, which was published in 1930, created tremendous obstacles for Asian actors to play Asian roles, I think.
And it seems like it lasted longer in Hollywood or in our culture than the ban on African Americans.
Well, that's true, because, you know, in a way, that's why, you know, Charlie Chan is fascinating, is that yellow face performance. If you think about all the white actors who, you know, did Charlie Chan, you know, including Warner Oland, Sidney Toler, followed by Roland Winters, especially the first two, you know, Warner Oland was a really great actor. He was so good at, doing the other, kind of racial other, right? I mean, he started out as a Swedish actor. You know, he started out by making a name for himself in 1927 Al Jolson's The Jazz Singer. So he played a Jewish character, and it was pretty convincing. And then he went on to...
Is he the guy who plays Jolson's father in that picture?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was the Jewish cantor, you know,
right.
Father figure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I can see him now. I can understand. Yeah, I see him now in my mind's eye. And he looks just like Charlie Chan. Not at all like Charlie Chan.
No, not at all. He actually only had a one word, you know, line in that whole movie, which is actually Hollywood's first talkie, so called.
He said stop or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Stop.
Who do you think was better as Charlie Chan, Warner Oland or Sidney Toler?
Well, everyone has their own favorite, but for me, it's definitely Warner Oland. And he was so serious about it. You know, he would read up on Chinese, he would study Chinese language, read up on Chinese philosophy and art. And so occasionally he was able to deliver a few lines in Chinese.
Yeah. It seems like the films with Sidney Toler are funnier than the ones with Warner Oland.
Well, here's a little secret, actually, about the making of Charlie Chan films, and I wrote about it in my book, is that, Warner Oland was an alcoholic, and he literally drank himself to death, you know, in 1938. Between 1931 and 37, he made about 16 Charlie Chan films, and with each film, it's funny that, since he was a drinker, and the directors at the beginning really liked the fact, you know, he would drink because it will make him, you know, put a kind of perennial grin on his face, and because he, you know, feels a little tipsy, I guess. And also, it slows down his speech so he could deliver better Charlie Chan lines in a slower kind of imitating the sing-song quality of that kind of, you know, English. And So Sidney Toler, however, was not really a drinker, not a heavy drinker at least, but the director followed that practice, you know, by making Sidney Toler have a little sip before every shooting. And I guess And I guess, you know, Roland Winters wasn't such a great Charlie Chan. May have something to do with the fact he didn't drink.
Well, Roland Winters, I guess, kind of killed the franchise when he came in. It was sort of, or was it already done? I don't know.
Yeah, well, he came in, but the series, you know, was really winding down. But that's also, you know, the series ended in 1949, and we have to remember this is actually a critical moment in American culture, but also in this kind of Sino-U.S. relationship. And I write about it about it in the book, what I call the turning point of the fate of Charlie Chan in American popular imagination. And I think a lot of the negative, you know, images we now associate with Charlie Chan really has something to do with that, you know, the tarnishing of his image in the 1950s and 60s. And so let me explain, if I may.
Absolutely.
Well, if you remember, the last Charlie Chan film starring Roland Winters, I think it's called The Sky Dragon, was touring the United States, was being shown around the country in the summer of 1949. That was also the moment when America was literally kind of mourning the loss of China, because that was the end of Chinese Civil War, in which, you know, Mao's communists, you know, defeated the nationalists who were unwisely supported by America. And so when Mao announced on October 1st, 1949, that this is the founding of the People's Republic of China, you know, from the Americans' perspective, it was as if, you know, the whole continental Asia was being, you know, swallowed up in a sea of redness. So for Charlie Chan to continue to wisecrack, you know, because, you know, after the series, you know, ended, Fox and other, you know, movie studios and the movie was being shown on theaters and TV, etc., it was still running strong. But in American culture, however, because that was the beginning of Cold War, you know, 1951-50, and there's the Korean War, everything. In that Cold War propaganda and anti-Chinese, anti-communist, you know, paranoia, almost everything Chinese, you know, picked up kind of negative, insidious connotation. And for Charlie Chan to continue to wisecrack in that kind of poisoned air, really this, you know, his image, some, you know, serious damage.
We're talking with Yente Wang, and his new book is called Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. Now, you were born, when were you born?
I was born in 1969.
69, and you came to America in the 90s, is that right?
1991, after I graduated from Peking University.
So what were your first impressions of the portrayal of Asians in American popular culture?
Well, it's hard to say. I can't really recall the first film I saw, because in China then, I already saw, you know, a few films. But I also have to explain this, I grew up, you know, watching Chinese opera, like Peking opera, mm-hmm. or a lot of regional operas. You know, doing the other, it's really something deeply ingrained in Chinese cultural imagination. You know, when you think about Peking opera, you know, cross-dressing is taken for granted. You know, men playing women, women playing men, etc. So this kind of imitation is really part of the artistic culture. So when, you know, I should tell you also, you know, Charlie Chan films were tremendously popular in China and other parts of Asia.
Did you see any of that?
In
the 30s, not
yeah, in the 1930s. In 1930s, yes, they were tremendously popular. Mm. The question is why? You know, I think it has something to do with Chinese nationalism, because, you know, in contrast to the, you know, Fu Manchu movies, which were banned in China, Charlie Chan portrayed, you know, films portrayed a good Chinese, for that matter. So I had that. That's one aspect. And the other aspect is really is the Chinese kind of acceptance or you know, acceptance of ventriloquism, for that matter. So I think that's always kind of part of Chinese artistic culture. So for me, to see Charlie Chan on the film, you know, when I first ran into these films, saw these films, honestly, they didn't offend me, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess you could say, is it offensive if a non-deaf person plays a deaf person, or if a non-blind person plays a blind person? I realize it's a different thing, but it's mm-hmm. also sort of the same thing.
Well, I mean, coming from China, I should say, Gary, this is really something fascinating about American culture. I just explained, the Chinese kind of, fondness for imitation. Mm-hmm. But America, it's another great place for that. We just talk about, blackface, and we talk about Warner Olin's Jew face performance. Mm-hmm. We can also talk about red face and now yellow face. This kind of ethnic fusion, of course, is it represent, there's deep-rooted racism in it. But out of this kind of toxic soil of racism, artistic, flowers did blossom. So that's something really unique about American culture, and Charlie Chang is really a great example. To me, he's really, the embodiment of both kind of the racist legacy, but also the creative genius of American culture. And we really cannot deny either.
Well, I've heard it argued that minstrelsy was a positive thing because it prepared Americans to accept African Americans as performers. Are you saying a similar thing about Charlie Chan?
No, I don't buy the argument. People ask me, if you say, racism, makes art more potent, are you celebrating racism? Of course not. What I'm saying is, a cultural historian, I want to say that we have to acknowledge that past, that without, racism, can you imagine, the sadness and beauty of jazz or blues? So am I suggesting we should have racism in order to have better art? No, not at all. What I'm saying is that this is the American fact, the American history, American, past that we have to acknowledge. So we have to know the whole story. And that's why, this book is contains different layers of this Charlie Chang story. Not just one, but many.
Yes, it's a very layered book, and I enjoyed that about it very much. In your book, you talk about how both Warner Olin and Sidney Toler were assisted by talented African-American comics, Step and Fetch It and Manton Moreland.
Right.
Do you have a theory about why they were so essential to the series?
Well, and that's really, shall I say, the insidious kind of, marketing strategy of Hollywood, and that's probably why Hollywood has been so successful. Because, especially with Manton Moreland, Charlie Chang films, like I told you, were tremendously popular, not just in China, in other parts of Asia. They were popular overseas. There's a huge overseas market for these films. But during World War II, that market was cut off. And that's when the Sidney Toler series, hired Manton Moreland, because it's like today using, Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker, in Rush Hour, because this is like two kinds of ethnic humor. It's a one stone, two birds, basically. Because of the cutoff of the loss of overseas market, Hollywood needed to, different kind of market. They turned to Afro-Americans, and that's why they hired black comedian, who turned out to be great, really, a great, bonus for the film.
Yeah, they're sort of doing their vaudeville act in the middle of the Charlie Chan movies.
Right, yes. Uh-huh.
Do you have a theory about why Number One Son, or whatever the Number One Son role was in each of the pictures, why that could be played by an actual Asian and not an American impersonator?
Well, that's the other reason, the Charlie Chang films were so offensive to some, to Asian Americans, is that, that's in a way that, people believe that prove that, Asians cannot play a leading role, which is true. When you think about Anna May Wong, et cetera, but to come back to Number One Son, Ki Luke, who is the Number One Son, who collaborated with Warner Olin for a long time, they had a great, you know, a relationship, almost like father and son relationship. And Ki Luk started out as an artist, you know, painting murals at you know, Grauman Chinese Theater until he was, you know, picked up to play some extra, and then, you know, and then he made it into Charlie Chan films, and he had a great career. Despite that, for instance, there was an infamous kind of you know, example, which is the making of Pearl Buck's The Great Earth. You know, Ki Luk wanted to play the leading role, but MGM at the time said, "Oh, you look too Chinese." You know,
let's get a Jewish guy to play the part.
Exactly. So to play a Chinese role, and Ki Luk looked too Chinese. Like, they ended up hiring Ki Luk and other, you know, Chinese or Asian, you know, actors as the extras, create the ambience, you know, in the background, but not, you know, as in the leading role. I mean, if that is not racism, what it is, it, you know.
Yeah. Oh, Paul Muni, I guess, did a good job, but.
Oh yeah, well, I'll have to give him the credit for that. But
not
that,
very,
you know,
convincing as an Asian, no. Well, let's talk a little bit. We're talking with Yonte Wong, and his book is a interesting look into the character of Charlie Chan and the real man who inspired Charlie Chan. Now, you describe this fellow, and the way you describe him, he seems more like a description of Charlie Chan's B-movie cousin, Mr. Moto, than Charlie Chan, and that he was athletic, small, carried a bullwhip.
That's true. He's actually even more wiry than Peter Lorre, although they are equally, you know, kind of short. Well, to give him tell him a story briefly, Chan Apana was born in Hawaii around 1870. He was the son of a Chinese coolie laborer who came to Hawaii to work on sugarcane plantations. And he went to China with his parents at the age of 3, and then came back at the age of 10. He became a paniolo, you know, Hawaiian for cowboy, and he worked on ranches, and then joined the police force in 1898, just when Hawaii was annexed by the United States. When the police, you know, department needed more manpower, and they also needed an insider, you know, to work on cases in Chinatown. So Apana was really a godsend for the department. And he almost immediately became a legend because he would walk the most dangerous beats in Chinatown carrying a bullwhip. And he himself is only 5 feet tall, and his bullwhip is the same length. So he would have, you know, coiled the whip around his waist. And he was the only police officer in that department who was allowed to carry a bullwhip in place of a gun. And a lot of the criminals actually were more afraid of the whip than the gun. So one time he could, you know, he single-handedly rounded up, you know, 40 people, like, you know, he rounded up like cattle. And so he became an inspiration for the fictional Charlie Chan. And Apana's story is really amazing, you know, for me as an immigrant, really, because, you know, we are talking about the, you know, the late 19th century and early 20th century. I mean, to use the parlance of that, you know, that period, Apana, who is illiterate, you know, he couldn't read or write in English or Chinese, as the son of coolie labor, in that period, he would have stood, really, you know, no Chinaman's chance, that, you know, the term of the time. But somehow he managed to make a name for himself. And so my book, in a way, this is one of the kicks, you know, to the truth of football. As Charlie Chan would say, you know, truth, like football, receive many kicks before reaching goal. In order to solve, you know, the Charlie Chan mystery, to find the truth about him, I really have to give this, you know, ball of football truth many kicks. And one kick, you know, is to give, you know, Chan Apana, this honorable detective, his rightful due in American history.
How did the author of Charlie Chan, Earl Der Biggers, become aware of Apana?
Well, that's the other Charlie Chan mystery that I had to solve in the book. Earl Der Biggers, you know, a small town kind of, you know, Ohio Buckeye who went to Harvard. You know, his parents had to borrow money to send him to Harvard. And, you know, he didn't have any family connection, But he was a big fan of popular culture, unlike T.S. Eliot, who also went to Harvard almost at the same time, almost. They overlapped for a year. But anyway, Biggers became a mystery writer after he graduated from Harvard. And he was overworked, and then he went to Hawaii, vacationed in Waikiki. And as the story goes, it was on the beach of Waikiki that he came up with the idea of doing a mystery, a Hawaii mystery, a detective novel for that matter. But at that time, there was really no Charlie Chan. According to Biggers himself, he saw the name of Chan Apana and Apana's colleague Lee Fook in an article in an obscure corner of a Honolulu newspaper that Biggers was reading in the reading room of New York Public Library. And I did a little research, and I write about it in my book as well, that claim, is really as fishy as the fifth ace on the river, if you know my metaphor. But no matter where or when or how he found, that newspaper item, Biggers was aware of, Chan Apana, because his name was in those papers in those decades, Hawaii papers, and he was quite well known. So
Biggers got rich off the story of Charlie Chan. Did he share his riches with the real life Charlie Chan?
Well, he did try to, yes, he was a big, became a bestseller, and he was able to buy a house in Pasadena. He moved to Pasadena from northeast, because he has health problems, and so he moved to the Sunshine, in California. He bought a great house, which is still stood today, in Pasadena, California Boulevard. But Chan Apana, however, remained, to use Charlie Chan's term, a kind of lowly Chinaman, making about $200 a month or something. And Biggers, to his credit, did try to get a role in a film for Chan Apana, but at that time Chan Apana was already, too old, too weak, but he didn't speak English either, so he couldn't really do anything. But they did meet twice, really. And their meeting, the first meeting, was really fascinating. Biggers went to Hawaii again after he had published a few Charlie Chan novels. He went to Hawaii in 1928. Almost immediately, he asked to meet up with Chan Apana at a Royal Hawaiian Hotel. And it was, to me, it's a historical meeting. It's like a kung fu battle, The creator of Charlie Chan and the real Charlie Chan, what they're going to say. So Apana brought an interpreter, his nephew. They met up and they took a picture. Oddly enough, that picture was not released to the press except for a local local Hawaiian newspaper. But to the national newspapers, was another photo was really, another photo was released. And in this photo, it was Earl Dare Biggers and with a standing Charlie Chan. And I did a little, research, and I'm pretty sure that Charlie Chan, that guy, it was the bellhop of the hotel, a young Chinaman who, was wearing a robe and who looked really more like Charlie Chan than Chan Apana, because at that time Chan Apana was a really kind of wrinkled old man, who have bear no resemblance to the fictional Charlie Chan.
Well, we're talking with Yante Wong, and his book is called Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. And it's a great book, and it's been very well received. You've been written up in the New York Times, and there was a big article in New Yorker that must have been gratifying.
Yeah, I was thrilled, really. And there are about, if you don't count the syndicated pieces, there are about 50 reviews out there right now.
So that's, congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
And this work seems like a culmination of a lot of years of study and planning. What are you going to do for an encore?
Well, for an encore, Well, once again, you know, this is like, as Charlie Chan would say, you know, a door of opportunity swing both ways. You know, first of all, I stumbled upon Charlie Chan novels, right, at an estate sale in Buffalo, and I immediately got hooked by the character. And so this topic has been, you know, kind of a, my fascination for about two decades. But I never really planned to write a book about it. You know, it's something you like. You know, I watched all the Charlie Chan films. I tried to, you know, find all the paperbacks, you know, the first editions, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really my hobby. So it's always at the back of my mind. For years I've been trying to write about the other book, which is my Alabama memoir. When I first came from China, I landed of all places in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. You know, I spent 3 years there as a student, but also ran a restaurant, you know, as a restaurant owner, et cetera, you know, delivering food all over town in the deep south as a Chinese man, and how I felt about it. So all these years, I've been trying to write a memoir, tentatively entitled, you know, Yellow Alabama. But one day I was talking to my friend, and also my agent, about this Alabama memoir, which seemed to be going nowhere for a while. Over the phone, I was telling him about, you know, my fondness for Charlie Chan and also the fact that I knew a real Charlie Chan. So he stopped me, you know, he said, "Look, Yunta, I think you better write this book first." It turns out, you know, he's right. And then he's also right in another aspect. And there's a reason I think I got stuck with that memoir. Because Charlie Chan is really like an iconic Chinaman, you know. That in order for me even to understand completely my own experience in America, I probably have to solve the Charlie Chan mystery first. And as you know, this book is also kind of a history of Chinaman in the United States. So in order to understand my own experience in the deep south of America, I really have to look back the whole Chinese experience or Asian American experience, you know, and then I can, you know, write about my own experience in a more interesting way. So probably my next project, you know, will be go back to this memoir.
Well, I look forward to that. Will you come back and talk to us some more when that happens?
I would love to, yeah.
Well, Yunta Huang, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back next week for another one. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely and talented Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. And I want to thank our guest, Yunta Huang, for being with us this week. His book is called Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.